If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hello and welcome to Life of the Week from History Extra, where leading historians delve into the lives of history's most intriguing and significant figures. When Kublai Khan became ruler of the Mongol Empire in 1260, it stretched from the Sea of Japan all the way to Eastern Europe. That Kublai was able to hold this vast territory together for the most part and mastermind the unification of China is testimony to his capabilities as a leader. Speaking to Spencer Mizzen in today's Life of the Week episode, Nicholas Morton reveals how Kublai built on the extraordinary achievements of his grandfather Genghis.
So hi there, Nick. Thank you for joining us today. We're going to talk today about Kublai Khan. So I wonder if you could start by giving our listeners a quick introduction to Kublai Khan. Who was he in a nutshell?
Okay, so it's the early 13th century, and Chinggis Khan, or perhaps more famously Genghis Khan, his empire is expanding aggressively on multiple frontiers. One of those frontiers is into northern China, and this becomes a major area, a major war zone for the Mongols as they seek to broaden their empire and establish what will become an empire that spans from the Pacific seaboard in the northeast to the borders of Southeast Asia in the southeast, Damascus ultimately in the southwest, and Hungary and Poland in the northwest. So it will become a huge empire. And his various sons take a leading role on many of these different frontiers. Now, Kublai Khan is Chinggis Khan's grandson, and he's involved from an early stage in the wars of expansion in China. In time, he becomes the Mongol ruler in China and the great Khan over the entirety of the Mongol Empire, although, as we'll see, it's not quite as simple as that. But he has a long reign, and it's really Kublai Khan who is known as the main, or the most commonly referred to, Mongol ruler, Mongol emperor, who ruled over China for a very long time, all the way up to the end of the 13th century.
So can you tell us a bit about Kublai Khan's early life? As you said there, he was a grandson of Chinggis or Genghis Khan, who, of course, is one of the towering figures in world history. I mean, how did that shape his upbringing?
The simple answer is we don't know. But there are a few things we can take for granted, things that were just there in Mongol culture at the time. So he is a member of the imperial family, and it's not just any empire, it's the largest empire, the largest and fastest expanding empire of any region in the world at this time. And so that sets a backdrop to what he's doing. He will have been raised not believing, but knowing that the Mongols have a right to rule every human being on the entire planet because they feel they have a mandate from heaven to do that. And at this point, it doesn't actually look that implausible because the Mongols are conquering everywhere. And so it doesn't seem that unlikely that they will, in fact, realize that particular ambition. And so it's against that incredibly confident backdrop that he's raised. Now, being from a nomadic background, albeit a very imperial one, he will have been raised in a fair degree of luxury, but he will also have been raised with the traditional nomadic skills of riding, hunting, shooting, which will then serve him well and which have natural military applications. But as a reasonably young man, he's also very closely involved in his father's wars. His father's called Tuloy, in northern China. And Kublai Khan acquires lands. This is before he becomes a ruler. He acquires lands in China, and so he is raised in a very military context in the wars of expansion, whereby the Mongols are seeking to conquer as much of China as possible. So, yes, he's a Mongol. Yes, he has that background. Yes, he is inculcated in the Mongols' ideology and their beliefs, but it's in a very Chinese context and from a very early age. And his wife, who plays a very important role throughout his life, called Chabi, she is a Tibetan Buddhist. She represents a significant influence on his life, one that is not necessarily wholly Mongol, but involves various other cultural influences too. So yes, he is part of a conquering empire, but he has other influences from China particularly that shape his life and culture as it goes forwards.
Do we know if he met Genghis?
Well, that's a good question. He probably did, yes, but we have no record of it.
Now, speaking of Genghis, Kublai would have been one of many grandsons. Would he have at any point expected to be the supreme ruler of the Mongol Empire before that actually became a reality? Was he one of many competing grandsons and descendants of Genghis Khan? Or was he in some way marked out for power before he did actually take that power?
Not really, no. So in the wake of Chinggis Khan's death, he's got four main sons who have a serious claim to power. And those dynasties become the main imperial dynasties that shape the fortunes of the Mongol Empire going forwards. And power moves from one great Khan to another. It's not obvious that Kublai Khan's going to be lined up as the next successor. He's the grandson of Chinggis Khan, and that obviously has a degree of potency to it, but that's no guarantee, though. There's lots of grandsons of Chinggis Khan. There's no particular reason why it should be him that could aspire to be great Khan. His break comes, really, when his brother, Monka, becomes great Khan. And with Monka's death, then Kublai Khan is in a position then to make a move on power, because Monka died whilst on campaign in China. Kublai Khan already has a strong power base in China. And of course, China is very, very wealthy anyway. And so he's got substantial resources of troops and money available to him in a way that, and on a scale that, other claimants might not. So with that kind of basis, he does actually have a strong position to move and claim the position of Great Khan. But that couldn't really have been foreseen until very close to the event. And it's not uncontested. So when Kublai Khan makes his move to try and take the position of Great Khan, he has a rival contender who in many ways looks more promising for a long time in terms of his prospects for becoming Great Khan, Arika Bork. And he's backed by many of the other imperial dynasties, perhaps most importantly the Jochid dynasty, which controls what today would be most of modern-day Russia and Eastern Europe. So it's an enormous conglomeration of lands. And so, yes, Kublai Khan acquires the position of Great Khan, but he has limited support from the other imperial dynasties, and this then shapes his career, because he acquires the position of Great Khan, which means that he controls most of China and therefore Mongolia, the heartlands of the Mongol Empire. But everywhere to the west of that, his control is less secure. The Dzogchen dynasty in Russia and what today would be Eastern Europe, it does not really acknowledge his rule. There's not much communication between Kublai Khan and that area of the empire, which is vast. In the Middle East and Persia, you have an area of the Mongol Empire that becomes known as the Ilkhanate. They do acknowledge Kublai Khan's position as Great Khan, and yet it's an acknowledgement that he has no genuine power over the area. And there's another major region within Central Asia called the Chagatayid Khanate, and that too doesn't acknowledge Kublai Khan's rule. So he's Great Khan, and yet his ability to exert power over anywhere outside Mongolia and China is very limited.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hola.
Hello. This call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow. Ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Now, it's impossible to tell the story of Kublai Khan without telling the story also of China. I mean, he was responsible for overseeing the unification of China. In your estimation, how great an achievement was that? And how did he go about doing that?
This is the million-dollar question. This is the background music. In fact, it's often the foreground music to his entire life, in that he is coming from a conquering culture, the Mongol Empire, and the threat of steppe invasion has been in the background of China's imagination, sometimes also in the foreground of the Chinese imagination, for centuries. And so in many ways, the advent of the Mongols fully realizes that fear that the steppe invaders have been successful and conquered China, or much of it. At this point, at least, even when Kublai Khan becomes Great Khan, southern, particularly southeastern China is still unconquered. But yes, what does he do with that? Because China has an enormous population. And how do you go about ruling it, particularly as it's a predominantly agricultural civilization? And the Mongols do well in areas where they can graze their horses on the vast grasslands of the Central Asian steppe, but China doesn't offer that. So how does he conquer it? How does he hold it, given the size of China's population, and also given the various beliefs and religions that shape China's identity? Taoism, Buddhism, Confucianism. Now, Kublai Khan himself was raised according to the shamanistic beliefs of the Mongol Empire. So it's a very different environment. And so he's got all sorts of pieces in the jigsaw puzzle that he's got to bring together in order to make his empire work. And something that he does, which is also what a lot of Mongol leaders do elsewhere, is he shows a strong degree of, for the most part at least, of religious tolerance. He tries to strike a balance between the various different religious and belief groups in China, which isn't easy, not merely because many of them aren't reconciled to the Mongols, but because they're also not reconciled to each other. And so he's got to manage their rivalries along with the danger of hostility to him as well. And that shapes his rule. It also shapes his identity too. Kublai Khan seems to have been very much attracted by Tibetan Buddhism, for example. It's not clear that he ever sort of fully internalized those beliefs and that they became his main belief system, but he was influenced by it, not least through his wife, but also in his culture, in the cities he built, in the laws he instituted. Many of them represent some kind of meeting point between Chinese culture and Mongol culture. And so in the cities he built, there were often great parks, and he would often live in tents in the Mongol style, but in imperial parks in these massive cities, many of which were laid out and designed very much according to Chinese patterns and designs. So he's trying to balance these factors, but it's difficult. And it's difficult. It's a challenge he's voluntarily taken on. I mean, he's part of the conquering culture, but nonetheless, he wants to make sure that he's got at least some legitimacy, or he wants to try to achieve some legitimacy with his Chinese subjects. But at the same time, his Mongol peers, they are very concerned, even before he becomes Great Khan, that he's gone too far, that he's moved too far away from his nomadic Mongol roots and adopted too much of an identity as a Chinese emperor rather than a Mongol Great Khan. And these tensions don't go away. There are plenty of people throughout his reign, including some who are prepared to take the field against him because they feel that he's moved too far away from the centre ground of Mongol culture. Whereas, of course, to many people in many parts of China, he's still a Mongol invader, whatever he does. So he's got to keep these things in tension. Sometimes he does it better than others, but it's very, very difficult.
So how did life change for the ordinary? I know it's so difficult to answer this if I generalise him, but how did life change for the ordinary people of China underneath Kublai Khan?
Life changes in a whole range of ways. I think I want to start with perhaps just the core fact that they are now under Mongol rule. So that a steppe people now rules their empire. And that will obviously have been a major sort of challenge to the thought world of the people now under Mongol control. But in other respects, the laws change. The Mongols institute a hierarchy in society whereby they're at the top, going down through various rungs until you get to southern Chinese at the bottom. So that will obviously have changed the way in which society was organized. The Mongols strongly sponsor mercantile activity in a way that hadn't been done previously. That's another way. The Mongols also sort of round out their impact. The Mongols also begin a series of major building projects. And so they substantially expand the Grand Canal, the idea being that by doing that, if the northern parts of China suffer a famine, they can bring up foodstuffs from the south. So there is a mixture of factors here. The Mongols are also interested in science, and they look to recruit the best intellectual and scientific minds. That includes, interestingly, recruiting some thinkers and intellectuals from the Muslim world who they then bring to China in order to staff the various institutions they create to that end. Taxation changes. Many of the Mongols, or many of Kublai Khan's leading ministers, are deeply unpopular because of the taxation demands made on the population. And it also, there's also, of course, the loss of life. When the Mongols invade northern China, later on when they invade Song China, southern China, the loss of life seems to have been very, very substantial. And whilst I don't claim that this is solely due to military action, it may well be due to disease and other factors, historians have concluded that China's population goes steeply down during this sort of era. So again, that sets up a variety of different factors which contextualize Kublai Khan's career. There's rebellions to him, but there's also plenty of people who are prepared to support him as well. So it's a mixed picture. It's not simple.
So let's step away from China for a little bit. What other arenas did he operate in? Am I right in saying he attempted an invasion of Japan during his reign?
Okay, so Kublai Khan's early career is spent fighting in northern China And then towards the end of the earlier phase of his career, before he becomes Great Khan, he is part of the various campaigns against southern China, the Song Dynasty. And then when he becomes Great Khan, he continues his wars against Song Dynasty China. And this is a massive military undertaking. The Song Dynasty is thought to have had up to 1 million soldiers under its command. It's the wealthiest part of China, huge population, very wealthy. It's got a lot of resources at its disposal. And so Kublai Khan spends much of his career seeking to overthrow Song Dynasty China, which he does ultimately succeed in doing. And he does that through a number of different routes. He uses large numbers of Chinese soldiers alongside his conventional Mongol forces. He also develops a navy, which is an unfamiliar thing for a Mongol empire to do. It's not something they do typically elsewhere. They do try briefly to do it in the 1290s in Baghdad, looking towards the Indian Ocean, but that's not met with much success. And so that conquest is the major undertaking of Kublai Khan's career. But as you say, he also looks to conquer other regions as well. The conquest of Korea takes place both before and during, to some extent, his career. And Kublai Khan sends various emissaries to Japan, demanding that they submit to the Mongol Empire. This is totally normal practice for the Mongols. They send envoys for regions as far afield as Southeast Asia or Eastern Europe or the Middle East. And their demands typically are submit to the Mongol Empire and pay tribute or we'll invade. And it's normally as simple as that, at least in the early phases of the Mongol Empire. But the Japanese have no intention of submitting to the Mongols, and so they basically ignore the Mongols' envoys. And so the Mongols try to invade. And so as a result, they put together a major fleet, drawing upon their subjects in Korea to provide naval forces. And so in 1274, they stage their first attempted invasion. It goes very badly. The land invasion grinds to a halt fairly quickly, and then heavy winds break up the fleet, and that brings about the fleet's withdrawal. But after that, the war of words continues. Kublai Khan is still very determined to bring about the conquest of Japan. And because the Mongol dynasty is founded on the ideology that it must conquer the world, it cannot accept defiance of its claims to rule the world, it becomes an ideological imperative that it should reinvade Japan and therefore bring about its full-scale subjugation. So in 1281, Kublai Khan launches his new invasion, a bigger fleet, a larger army. The Japanese have had time to prepare for his coming, but nonetheless, this is a very significant invasion force. And it makes its initial invasion, it makes its landing, it's met by the Japanese samurai in battle. The Mongol forces don't make much progress in the early phases of their campaign, and they raft together their fleet by tying all their various ships together. It becomes one sort of almost sort of floating city. And this is when the Mongol fleet is hit by a typhoon or kamikaze, which then destroys the fleet. And therefore, this is the end of Kublai Khan's second invasion of Japan. He wants to do another one, but really his advisors are making it perfectly clear to him by this point that's simply not going to happen. His resources are overstretched. He doesn't have the money. So what we're looking at in the Mongol invasions of Japan is what we also see, for example, in the Middle East with the Mongol invasions into the Mamluk Empire. They reach a point where actually they can't push any further. They've reached the maximum extension of their empire and they're struggling to go any further. And it has to be said as well that Kublai Khan is not simply facing opponents or seeking to conduct expansionist warfare. He also faces challenges from the Mongol Empire as a whole, his own empire, because there's plenty of those other imperial dynasties I mentioned earlier on who are not reconciled to him as Great Khan. They feel he's gone far too far beyond traditional Mongol culture, and so they seek to displace him or to erode his authority, and so he also has to watch out for challenges from the Central Asian steppe as well. And so in an ironic situation, Kublai Khan may himself have been the representative of a steppe-invading culture into China. But by the end of his career, he is in many ways also concerned about steppe invasion, just as the very people he had himself been involved in conquering had historically been as well.
What do we know about Kublai Khan as a person? Is there much testimony as to what his character was like, how he related to those people around him?
He seems to have been very able. I'm not sure you could have done what he did without being extremely able. I mean, getting really to understand his personality is different. We have various accounts. We have Islamic accounts, Chinese accounts. There's Marco Polo's account of his journey to China as well. They all give some indication of his character, but how much we can rely on these to accurately reflect what he was actually like is difficult to say. There are certain things that can be said with reasonable confidence. Clearly, he's very able in terms of simple organisational and military ability. You just couldn't do this without that. It seems likely that he retained his steppe shamanistic beliefs throughout his life, although he was strongly influenced, particularly by Tibetan Buddhism. But as I've mentioned, he also practiced, like so many Mongol leaders, a form of religious tolerance in the sense that he wanted all the various beliefs and religions in China, just as other Mongol rulers did elsewhere, to use their spiritual force, as they understood it, for the betterment of the Mongol Empire. That's not entirely consistent, though. There is a period towards the end of his life where he initiates a substantial persecution of Muslims within China. So that's not entirely consistent, but that is his broad policy. He's a builder. He wants to build cities and canals and other works of infrastructure, although in time he struggles to pay for these ventures. And as is so often the case with rulers who have power on this scale, you do begin to wonder over time just how much the exercise and anxieties that are generated by enormous power begin to erode people's personalities and their resilience until the concerns and paranoias of that power begin to set in. I don't know that, but I sense the presence of it sometimes in some of his choices and policies. Ultimately, he spends most of his career trying to first conquer China and then perhaps investing even more effort in trying to retain control, which he finds much more difficult, particularly given the various factions within his empire. He's clearly devoted to his wife, and she plays a major role in his life, and her death is a major turning point for him in terms of his own energies and his own the trajectory of his life. His son dies, his main successor dies soon after his wife, or a few years after his wife. That too will have had an impact on him, presumably, as well, not least because he's his named successor. So these are various aspects which we can speculate about or be reasonably confident about. He's also a very heavy drinker and suffered increasingly from gout. This, again, it's a classic feature of Mongol culture where the consumption of very large quantities of fermented mare's milk called kumis is a major staple of life. I'm not sure if that was his drink of choice, but that was certainly the case for many Mongol leaders.
Now, you mentioned Marco Polo a few minutes ago. I wonder if we could dig into his story a little bit. I mean, what was his interaction with Kublai Khan and what do his accounts reveal about Kublai Khan?
Okay, so Marco Polo, with his father and his uncle, they're Venetians, and they wanted to trade with the Mongol Empire. And that's an entirely natural thing for merchants in Eurasia to want to do. Having conquered empire after empire, civilization after civilization, the Mongols have wealth that's out of proportion to any other society anywhere in the world at this time. And so merchants are about making money, and so they go where the money is. And so, as a result, the trade routes begin to reorientate themselves around the Mongols' major cities. And, of course, the things the Mongols want become the things the merchants go and find for them, because that's what they'll spend their money on. And so there's a sort of economic logic to this. And so the Polos are among those many merchants flocking to the Mongol courts in order to sell their wares. And so they originally approach the descendants of the Dzogchid dynasty in, it's called the Golden Horde, which is the part of the Mongol Empire which encompassed much of Russia and Eastern Europe. And from there, they then go on to China, where they meet Kublai Khan. And Kublai Khan expresses an interest in them. He expresses an interest in Christianity. It's a standing feature of Kublai Khan's policy, really, that he expresses an interest in every religion. It seems to be part of the way he manages the incredibly diverse religious cultures under his authority. And Marco Polo and his uncle and father return briefly to Venice, but then they return. And Marco Polo rises, or seems to rise, or he tells us he rises, in the Mongol bureaucracy in China. And so he plays a role for many years within Kublai Khan's bureaucracy, and then he continues his travels and then returns back to Venice. His life story is important, it's interesting, but I think, for me at least, the thing that stands out about Marco Polo is his role, like the role of many merchants, missionaries, envoys, diplomats from across Eurasia. Because of the nature of the Mongol Empire, because there is a strong reason for these travellers to go to the Mongol courts, whether they're in China, Mongolia, Central Asian steppe, or the Middle East, suddenly people are travelling, and they're travelling enormous distances, and they're travelling to places that previously were basically unknown to them. And you see this with Marco Polo, but you also see it with envoys from so many other cultures as well, that they're going to these places that are simply blank spaces on their world map. They have no idea what's there. And so Marco Polo returns with stories about cultures and cities and peoples that are totally unfamiliar in Western Christendom. There are Armenian envoys from the Middle East who go to the great Khans and return with news of animal species and birds they've never heard of before. The Mongols themselves send out envoys to places as bizarre and far-flung as the Kingdom of France or the Kingdom of England, and return with tidings. Their particular interest is birds of prey, because they realise that Scandinavian birds of prey are extremely good, and so they send out envoys to go and get them. And there's all sorts of stories of this nature. One of my favourites is when the Mamluks, and the Mamluks are the Muslim rulers of Egypt, they send ambassadors to a Mongol city, and the Mongols say, "Oh, you're from Egypt. Is it true that we've heard that there's a huge river in Egypt?" "Yes, that's right, the River Nile." "We've heard that the only way you can cross that river is via an enormous bone, and the bone's so big that people can walk to and fro across it. Is that true?" And at this point, the Mamluk diplomats are incredibly tactful, and they say, "We haven't seen the bone." I suppose they didn't want to suggest that their Mongol negotiators were being naive in any way. But nonetheless, you can see through these questions, through these experiences, cultures from across Eurasia are becoming better informed about one another through this process. And it's not just news and information that's carried, it's technologies too. Gunpowder reaches the Mediterranean, and it seems very likely it was carried by merchants associated with the Mongols, or perhaps by the Mongols themselves. And that then has a profound effect on the Ottoman Empire, the Mamluk Empire, the Byzantine Empire, Western Christendom, among others. So the movement of technologies. In the same vein, when Kublai Khan was engaged in the suppression of the Song Dynasty in southern China, he had to get in some major fortress cities. And so he sent for and received a group of Muslim siege engineers who could manufacture counterweight trebuchets for him. And the counterweight trebuchet is a siege weapon developed almost simultaneously by the Crusaders and various Muslim societies in the Middle East. Within those wars, Kublai Khan learnt of its effectiveness, and so he asked for engineers to be sent to him who could then deploy that technology.
Okay, Nick, so did Kublai Khan leave the Mongol Empire in a stronger position, in your opinion, than the one in which he found it when he became supreme ruler?
I'm going to give a historian's answer to that question, if that's all right. Sort of. The civil war between Kublai Khan and Arika Bork that I mentioned earlier, which is the civil war that frames Kublai Khan's rise to power, that has a profound effect on the breakup of the Mongol Empire. All the various regions of the Mongol Empire still consider themselves to be part of a wider whole, but they're not going to be answering his instructions. They view Kublai Khan as a rival. The Ilkhanate, which is the Middle Eastern wing of the Mongol Empire, is prepared to pay lip service to Kublai Khan's supremacy, but that's about it. In practice, and sort of symbolism aside, they're really drifting apart into separate empires. And so the Middle Eastern Mongol Empire, the Ilkhanate, in time that it increasingly adopts Islam as its main religion and adopts sort of the culture of the region, just as Kublai Khan in China his empire and the style of his empire becomes a great deal more Chinese as it progresses over time. And again, in the Golden Horde, which, as I mentioned, encompasses much of Russia, for example, there too, it moves very much into the cultural orbit of the area, and it also converts to Islam as well. So the various regions of the Mongol Empire drift apart, and their rivalries over that civil war create fracture lines. So in a sense, the Mongol Empire substantially weakens itself because it is breaking apart. On the other hand, by completing the conquest of Song China, Kublai Khan has created a vast empire for himself. And Song China, before the Mongol conquest at least, was probably the most advanced and wealthiest part of the entire planet. So in terms of the total resources at the disposal of Mongol leaders, it's probably a high point in some respects, although it has to be said that by his final years, Kublai Khan's policies are looking a lot less effective. The failed invasions of Japan, the failed attempt to project authority into Southeast Asia. True, he hasn't lost China, but there's rebellions and the death of his heir. These are all weak points, as well as his own declining health. So there are signs of trouble, even in his final years.
And finally, how did he die? What happened to him in the end? And what happened to the empire in, say, the following 5 or 10 years after his death?
So he has a series of long-term health conditions, gout being the best known one. But having lost his son and heir, power then passes to his grandson. And for a time, over the next few decades, Mongol rule in China continues. But increasingly, as we move into the sort of the early to mid-14th century, Mongol rule in China begins to fall apart as rulers become embroiled in infighting between various different factions over who's going to be the emperor. And there's no end to the question of how you reconcile Mongolian steppe culture with the cultures of China. And that's something that never really goes away. It's never settled as an issue. And you get some leaders who are much more sort of Chinese inclined, others that are more Mongolian inclined. They both create friends and enemies for themselves, depending on which factions align with them. And against that, there's a sort of a background of growing resistance and rebellion to the Mongols, which eventually will prove decisive. And that will be the end of Mongol China, effectively.
That was Nicholas Morton, Associate Professor of History at Nottingham Trent University and author of The Mongol Storm, Making and Breaking Empires in the Medieval Near East, published by Basic Books in 2022.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.